Lecture 23, Judaism and the Other.
All ancient law codes made a distinction between the in-group and the out-group, and the law codes in the Hebrew Bible are no exception to that rule. But we want to take a look at how the Hebrew Bible and Rabbinic Judaism and Medieval Judaism and Modern Judaism understand the relationship to the outsiders and how that's changed over time. So the first biblical verse I want to take a look at is in Leviticus 24:22, which seems to suggest something unique within the world of the ancient Near East. "You shall have one standard for stranger and citizen alike, for I, the Lord, am your God." So does that mean that there isn't a distinction between insiders and outsiders? Not quite. Let's take a look at another biblical verse, this time from Deuteronomy 23. "You shall not deduct interest from loans to your countrymen, whether in money or food or anything else that can be deducted as interest, but you may deduct interest from loans to foreigners." So here we're making a distinction. The Bible is making a distinction between foreigners and strangers. Strangers are what we would call resident aliens. They're people that have come to the land of Israel and are living amongst you, even though they're not Israelites. They're not ethnically Israelites. While foreigners are people from outside that may be here temporarily, and they are unlike the resident alien for whom you are to have the same law as you would toward another Israelite. The foreigner from Moab or from Mesopotamia, there you do have this two-tiered legal system whereby they are judged by a different set of rules and they are extended a different set of rights than the ger, or the resident alien, the stranger, or the native Israelite. So it really has to do with how long they're in the land. So already we see that the Torah is trying to make some accommodations to those people who weren't born in the in-group, but have moved here for one reason or another, or moved to the land of Israel for one reason or another. The Torah also talks about ways of peace. The rabbis have this general category of the ways of peace that they get that language from the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 3 talks about her ways are pleasant ways and all her paths peaceful. Right? So that's in the Torah itself, that's in the Tanakh. And so the rabbis then derive a series of general principles about the Torah only being for nice, gentle, pleasant ways. There's a dispute between two of the great rabbis of the Mishnaic period, Rabbi Akiva and Ben Azai, as to what is the greatest principle in the Torah. Rabbi Akiva says, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Jesus said the same thing in the Gospels. "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." That's the greatest mitzvah, the greatest commandment in the Torah. Ben Azai disagrees. Ben Azai says, no, the greatest principle in the Torah is that God created all of humanity in the divine image. What's the distinction between the two? If I were to say that in Aramaic, as a good Talmudic scholar, I would say, what's the nafkamina? What's the practical difference? If I were to say it as a disciple of William James, what's the cash value? Right? What's the practical difference between these two positions, Rabbi Akiva and Ben Azai? Rabbi Akiva is setting a pretty high bar for love, but it's love for your neighbor. And your neighbor is generally an Israelite, somebody who lives right in your neighborhood, who shares your worldview, and is part of your own ethnic group. Ben Azai has a lower bar, right? Everyone's created in the divine image, so you need to accord to each person a certain amount of dignity for having been created in the divine image. So dignity, right, respect for the other, is perhaps easier to extend than love, but you have to extend it to a wider base. You have to extend it to everyone. So this kind of tension within Rabbinic Judaism is there from the very beginning. Do we just love those people that are just like us? Or, do we also extend respect and dignity for all of God's creation? Another statement from the rabbis. Our rabbis taught, "We provide support for the poor of the Gentiles along with the poor of Israel. and visit the sick of the Gentiles along with the sick of Israel, and bury the dead of the Gentiles along with the dead of Israel in accord with the ways of peace. So those nice things that we do that we're not specifically commanded in the Torah to do, but it falls under this general category of loving your neighbor and ways of peace, just like we do that to the Israelites and in the rabbinic period to Jews wherever they are, we should also extend the same courtesies to the Gentiles. Why? Because the Torah's ways are pleasant. The Torah's ways are to promote peace. And if you remember, in a previous lecture, we talked about the Hebrew loan associations that popped up in this country when the Eastern European immigrants first came to the shores as a way that the veteran Jewish Americans could lend a helping hand to their brethren that were newcomers, to the greenhorns that were just coming to this land. It turns out that many of those Hebrew free loan associations also extended credit and loaned money to Gentiles. The rabbis were very concerned about balancing rights and responsibilities. So if the Gentiles, they don't technically have rights, but we extend to them these pleasantries, but we also expect a certain level of behavior. The rabbis created something called the seven Noahide laws as a kind of minimum expectation of what it means to be a righteous Gentile. These seven laws are imagined by the rabbis to have been told by God to Adam in the Garden of Eden. It's very, very important for the rabbis that these laws are articulated to the founder of humanity, according to the biblical story, at the very beginning. Why? So that when the flood of Noah happens, the rabbis will feel as though the punishment of Noah's generation was justified because they broke laws that they knew about. It very much bothered the rabbis, who were also judges in their capacity as rabbis, that there would be this punishment recorded in the Torah, while it wasn't explicit that the generation of Noah knew what the laws were that they were violating. So the rabbis, in good midrashic fashion, read the following seven laws into God's first statement to Adam in the Garden of Eden. And the seven laws are as follows. There's one positive and six negative. Just like in the Decalogue, you've got more things that we shouldn't do than we should do. It's the same way in the seven laws of Noah. The thing that we should do, establish courts of law in your communities, right? Every society needs to be a lawful society where people know what the laws are and there's some kind of mechanism to hold people accountable for violating the laws. Now we have six negative commandments. Do not commit blasphemy toward the Lord. That's what you shouldn't do toward the real God. But you also shouldn't worship false gods or idols. So there are two ritual laws in the seven laws of Noah, right? Don't blaspheme the Lord, and don't commit idolatry. Do not commit incest or adultery. That is number four. Do not murder. Do not steal. And do not eat a limb from a live animal. Do not rip a limb from a live animal. In other words, cruelty to animals is also part of the seven laws of Noah, which some people like to think of as Judaism's version of natural law. This is what you would think of if you didn't have any kind of revealed religion. I'm not so sure, because the laws about blasphemy and idolatry, I'm not sure that a rational person would come up with those on his own. But in any case, according to the Talmud, according to the rabbis, that's what a non-Jew needs to do in order to be considered righteous and achieve salvation in the world to come, to achieve a portion of the world to come, to make it to life in the next phase. That's part of the reason why Judaism isn't a proselytizing religion, because there's nothing that you get out of becoming Jewish except more responsibility. But both Jews and non-Jews have the capability of making it into the world to come. The Jews have 613 commandments, although now that the temple isn't around, there are fewer. Thank goodness, I say in parentheses. And the Gentiles have seven, the seven laws of Noah. But the question became, in the Middle Ages, when Jews and Christians started living in close proximity to each other, in France in particular, is the Christian claim of the divinity of Jesus, that Jesus is God, is that idolatrous? Because if it is, then the Jews are, I'm sorry, then the Christians are idolaters, and there's a whole series of laws that go into effect in order to separate the Jews from the Christians. Because the Mishnah has a whole tractate called Idol Worship, Avodah Zarah, that talks about the relationships between the Jews and the pagan Romans, who were the idolaters of the Mishnaic period. And the idolaters of the Mishnaic period, at least as presented in rabbinic literature, they weren't just worshiping other gods, they were immoral. They engaged in sexual practices that the rabbis considered immoral, and they engaged in ritual sacrifices of human beings that the rabbis considered immoral. So in order to separate the two communities, the rabbis said, look, you can't do any business with idolaters 3 days before or 3 days after the days that they have their holy days or their sacrifices, because you don't want to be financing them for doing immoral things. So if you now transfer that to medieval France, that would mean that the Jews could never do business with the Christians, because 3 days before and 3 days after the Sabbath, their Sabbath, that's the entire week. So there were economic implications to how the Christians should be viewed. That's perhaps a cynical explanation. A less cynical explanation is that as a result of rubbing elbows with the Christians, the Jews saw that we're talking about a different kind of religious practice. There's nothing intrinsically, inherently immoral about Christianity. They have a different way of relating to their God, of offering prayer, and of understanding the triune nature of God, but it's not necessarily immoral in the way that the Roman pagans were necessarily immoral in the rabbinic eyes. Now, this is also a very interesting case study of comparative religious sociology. In the Muslim world, where you don't have too many Christians, I'm talking about North Africa and the Middle East, for the Muslims, Christianity is idolatry. Shirk is what the Muslims call that kind of association, and it's the cardinal sin. Associating anything with Allah is a terrible transgression for the Muslims. In the Jewish communities in Muslim lands, they similarly agreed with the Muslims that what Christianity was all about, or what was involved with Christianity, was idolatry. And they didn't have any sociological need to see Christians as anything other than idolaters, because it didn't affect their economic life. So for Maimonides and the Jewish community in the Sephardic world, in North Africa, in the Middle East, in the Muslim world, they continued to see the Christian community as idolaters. Even though in Maimonides' code, the Mishneh Torah that he wrote in 1180, he acknowledges that the Christians have also helped to extend the morals and the virtues that are presented in the Hebrew Bible all across the world. So he recognizes and appreciates the contributions to world morality that the Christians have engaged in, but nevertheless, their understanding of Jesus as fully human and fully God for Maimonides and the rest of the Muslim world is idolatry. Not so. Not so for the Jews in Ashkenaz, for the Ashkenazi Jews. They had good economic reasons as well as sociological reasons to reinterpret what idolatry was. And so in the 12th century, Rabbi Isaac made the distinction that the Christian association, or shituf, of Jesus with God is not prohibited for Gentiles who follow the Noahide laws. Association, it's not flat-out idolatry, it's associating something with God. Again, is it because the Jews saw that the Christians weren't immoral idolaters? Or, having a more cynical reading, is it because of the economic implications of considering French Catholics, the whole French world, the whole Ashkenazi world from France and Germany, to be idolaters, and therefore there wouldn't be any business or commercial interactions between the Jewish community and that idolatrous community. So we already have in the 12th century a statement that Christianity is not idolatrous because of their association of Jesus with God. But even more, in the early 14th century, we have Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri of Provence in what is today France. He argued that Christians were, quote, a people restricted by ways of religion, end quote, unlike the pagans and idolaters described in the Talmud. So it's not only that what the Christians were doing with the Trinity wasn't technically idolatry as the Talmud had defined it. It was association, something different. But the Christian people, they've got a good religion. They're restricted by morals. It's even more than saying it's not idolatrous. There's a positive statement that comes from the rabbinic establishment in the 14th century toward Christians. Now, then what are they saying? Look, from the Jewish perspective, Christians are mistaken about certain theological issues regarding Jesus and the unity of God. It's an intellectual mistake. It's an intellectual mistake, but it's not a moral failing. And just like Rabbi Akiva and Ben Azai can disagree, and Maimonides and Nachmanides can disagree, the Jews were willing to extend that same generosity to Christians. Okay, we have an intellectual disagreement about the nature of God, whether God is one or whether God is triune. But as long as the cash value of that difference doesn't come out to acts of immorality, then you know what? We're very willing, if not happy, to live in your midst, because Christianity is a religion that is constrained by morals and morality. In the modern period, I want to talk about a few developments in Jewish-Christian relations. Let's start with Catholicism and Judaism. The Second Vatican Council, which ran from 1962 to 1965, recognizes that God's covenant with the Jewish people remains intact. God, traditionally we have an Old Testament and a New Testament. Now the Catholics are more sensitive about their vocabulary, about their terminology of the books as well, because they have come to understand that God's covenant with the Jews didn't expire when Jesus came onto the scene to offer a new covenant. Now there are two covenants. It's not that one has stopped and the other one has picked up, but Judaism continues to be a living relationship with God, between God and the Jewish people, and Christianity is another expression of that relationship between God and the Jewish people. And here, it's a very nice metaphorical parallel. We talked about how in the Hebrew Bible, a man can marry multiple women. And we also talked about how the relationship between God and the Jewish people is compared to a wedding. So just like God can have multiple wives, just like a man can have multiple wives, God can have multiple relationships and multiple covenants with different people. And that seems to be the new model that's emerging between Jews and Christians. Furthermore, the Church in the Second Vatican Council repudiated anti-Semitism and the charge that the Jews were collectively responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus. So since the covenant between God and the Jews is intact, there's no need for Jews to convert to Christianity to achieve salvation. This had long been a historical sore point for Jews because historically, the Christian community has forced or tried to force or tried to persuade Jews to convert. I will tell you that as a result of living for 3 years in Nashville, I have been the object of proselytizing activity. And it's uncomfortable. And although I appreciate that the motive is to save my eternal soul, I do appreciate that. On a personal level, it strikes me as obnoxious that someone thinks that I need to be saved and that my religion and my relationship with God isn't sufficient for that end. Beyond the Catholic world, there have also been major efforts promoting Jewish-Christian dialogue. A recent statement by the Christian Scholars Group on Christian-Jewish relations offers the following points. God's covenant with the Jewish people endures forever. Jesus lived and died as a faithful Jew. That's something that is that historically was not well recognized, and it is very much recognized now within many church communities. Ancient rivalries must not define contemporary relations. It is true, and we should not try to sweep under the rug, that relationships between Jews and Christians historically has been one filled with bloodshed and animosity. We can recognize that, but not let it determine our future relationship. Judaism is a living faith, enriched by many centuries of development. This is a surprising point that needs to be made. It's surprising that this point needs to be made. But many Christians have the understanding that Judaism was synonymous with the religion of the Old Testament. And there wasn't a sensitivity to, just like the New Testament came after the Old Testament or after the Hebrew Bible, Rabbinic Judaism also has a more progressive and modern, relatively speaking, understanding. And that we, just like Christianity continued to develop, so too did Rabbinic Judaism. Furthermore, the fifth point in the statement by the Christian Scholars Group on Christian-Jewish relations is that Christians should not target Jews for conversion. They also affirm the importance of the land of Israel for the life of the Jewish people. And finally, Christians should work with Jews for the healing of the world. I don't want to leave people with the impression that all of the activity in the modern period has been from Christianity to Judaism. There have also been some Jewish statements recently of accommodation and rapprochement between the Jewish community and the Christians, especially since the Shoah, since the Holocaust. Jews have tried to, they've struggled to redefine their relationship with Christians. On the level of cooperation with Christian groups concerning social and political issues, issues of social justice, there's been widespread participation throughout the mainstream Jewish community. I should emphasize that I think Reform Judaism has done the best job of partnering with Christian churches and congregations in order to promote deeds of social justice. Reconstructionist Judaism is also aggressive in that direction. Less so, but somewhat, the conservative movement, and more so recently, they've tried to get together in interfaith groups in order to build ramps for disabled people that need ramps to go into their buildings and other such issues of social justice. The Orthodox, I believe, have been the slowest in coming on board to this idea of Jewish-Christian cooperation on issues of social justice, but there is no official explicit Orthodox resistance to that. It's just on the Orthodox agenda, there are other things that take priority. But there is official resistance to interfaith dialogue. So we need to make the distinction between Jewish-Christian dialogue and Jewish-Christian cooperation on issues of social justice. Many in the Jewish community, and not just in the Orthodox world, are, in my opinion, justifiably suspicious that part of what's going on in the motivation for Christians to engage in Jewish-Christian dialogue or interfaith dialogue is a conversionary motive. And so there is a certain reluctance to engage in interfaith dialogue. Within the Orthodox community, I think that suspicion and that resistance is perhaps most pronounced. But you've got a leader of the modern Orthodox world, Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, who has the following to say: each religious community is endowed with intrinsic dignity and metaphysical worth. And what he means by that is that we really don't have anything to talk about. I can read about what you believe, and you can read about what I believe, but to try to change our faiths in any significant or substantive way as a result of a dialogue diminishes or depreciates the intrinsic dignity and metaphysical worth of our religions. We don't want to say that Christianity is metaphysically unworthy or doesn't have intrinsic dignity. Please don't say that about Judaism. Let's continue to develop our own religions, but not necessarily in cooperation. We have our own irreconcilable understandings of the way that God requires us to be in this world. So even though there is a conservative, with a small c, reluctance to engage in interfaith dialogue, it doesn't also amount to a condemnation of Christianity in any way. Other Jews, including some Orthodox, are willing to engage in interreligious dialogue. And Dabru Emet is a recent statement by Jews on Christians and Christianity. They say the following: Jews and Christians worship the same God. That's an important point. And recently Muslims have also made that point, that Jews and Christians and Muslims, we all worship the same God. So that's a good place to start from in any kind of interfaith dialogue. We might express our worship differently, and we might disagree intellectually with how one another worships that God, but at least if we can start from the common ground of worshiping the same God, that's already a huge step. Number two, Jews and Christians accept the moral principles of Torah. And that's phrased very delicately. It's not that the moral laws are obligatory, but we accept the moral principles of the Torah, both Jews and Christians. Love your neighbor as yourself, all of those wonderful moral maxims in Leviticus 19, for instance, not cursing the deaf, not placing a stumbling block before the blind. We want to emphasize what we have in common without ignoring or minimizing what separates Jews from Christians or Judaism from Christianity. Number three in this statement by Jews, Dabru Emet: the humanly irreconcilable difference between Jews and Christians will not be settled until God redeems the entire world as promised in Scripture. That's something that Jews and Christians can agree about. There's going to be redemption. Now, whether it's going to be redemption number one or Jesus' second coming, that's something that we won't know until it happens. And then we can point fingers and say, I was right, you were wrong, you were right, I was wrong, right? However way it goes. But we both agree that redemption is coming. And so let's focus on working toward redemption. And that's the fourth point. The fourth point is, a new relationship between Jews and Christians will not weaken Jewish practice. So it shouldn't, this addresses the Jewish concern, the Jewish suspicion that there's some kind of proselytizing motive in any interfaith dialogue. No, not at all. It shouldn't diminish our commitment to the Judaism as we understand it should be practiced, whether that's in the Orthodox variety or conservative or Reconstructionist or Reform. That third point, that we look forward to redemption, that really feeds into the whole program of working together toward redemption, which grows out of this interfaith dialogue. Okay, our next and final lecture will take us from Jewish perceptions of the other to Jewish perceptions of ourselves. Are Jews the chosen people?